Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Today, we're spending the hour discussing media coverage of the election, Tuesday night's debate, and what is at stake. Here is a compilation of the debate from The Recount.
Kamala Harris, let's have a good debate.
Nice to see you. Have fun.
She's a Marxist. Everybody knows she's a Marxist. Her father's a Marxist professor in economics, and he taught her well.
I'm going to invite you to attend one of Donald Trump's rallies, because it's a really interesting thing to watch. And what you will also notice is that people start leaving his rallies early.
What they have done to our country by allowing these millions and millions of people to come into our country in Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in.
So let's talk about what is important in this race. It is important that we move forward, that we turn the page on this same old tired rhetoric.
I probably took a bullet to the head because of the things that they say about me. They talk about democracy. I'm a threat to democracy. They're the threat to democracy.
Donald Trump was fired by 81 million people. Clearly, he is having a very difficult time processing that.
Joining us are three journalists. Chris Lehman is DC Bureau Chief for The Nation, contributing editor at The Baffler, and author of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Rose. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Hassan Ali Kanu is an award-winning reporter for The American Prospect. Hi, Hassan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. It's my pleasure.
And Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic. Hi, Alex. Thank you so much for joining us again.
It's great to be back with you.
Well, great to have all of you. First off, let's talk about your overall assessment of the debate. It was the first time that Donald Trump and Kamala Harris met. Chris, let's start off with you. What really stood out for you?
Well, what really stood out for me is that I think at long last, after 9 years of kind of fake mythology in the media about the political genius of Donald Trump, it was pretty much an emperor naked moment. Kamala Harris, I thought, very effectively targeted Trump's principal weakness and the principal weakness of all narcissists, which is his bottomless self-regard. So the moment that she pivoted and said, you know, you should go to one of Trump's rallies, people there are, you know, he's talking nonsense, people are exhausted and bored and leaving early. There's nothing more inflammatory to a narcissist than to be told you're boring and not worthy of attention. And that's when Trump just, you know, threw aside whatever preparation he might have done and just started riffing about things like immigrants eating dogs in Ohio and sexual reassignment surgery for undocumented immigrants in jail. It was like MAGA Mad Libs at that point. And Harris, I thought, continued hammering away at that specific weak point and actually called Trump weak at one point, which again, you could just, even looking at his facial expressions at those moments, you can just sort of see his head about to explode. It's a welcome object lesson. It's also a sort of more sober reminder that why should it have taken 9 years for our political culture to realize that this guy is a really fragile, easily upset blowhard who can be deflated with a few choice words.
Alex, you wrote a piece, Kamala Harris just destroyed Donald Trump in the debate. She set the traps and he dumbly walked right into them. What would you like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly echo and underline everything that Chris just said. But, you know, one of the more frustrating storylines from certainly the earlier part of this election and this year was this idea that there was a new Donald Trump, that he was disciplined, he was embracing a message, he was pivoting to the center. That in the lead up to this debate, you had stories too that were, you know, about how he was, you know, Tulsi Gabbard and Matt Gaetz of all people had convinced him to drive a disciplined message. And I think that the message that they were trying to work out was the one that would have hit Harris's weak spots. It would have tied her to Joe Biden and frustrations about inflation and immigration. And instead, you saw that not only is Donald Trump not normal or more measured, he has not changed since his assassination attempt. In fact, he is more deranged than ever. He was a lunatic. And I think if you compare it to even the darkest moments in the sort of 2016 Hillary Clinton debates, which were very dark, there was still a clarity to a lot of what Trump was doing and saying. And there was a form, a demented form, but a form of message discipline there too, in the way that he attacked Clinton. And what you saw tonight was, you know, Harris's maneuvers were so simple. You could see them coming from a mile away. And yet, you know, he interrupted, you know, the question about his strongest issue, according to polls, immigration, to talk about crowd sizes for a minute. It was remarkable.
Hmm. What about you, Hassan? What were your thoughts on the debate? What stood out for you?
I can certainly echo the points that Chris and Alex have made as well. I think what's also important to point out, I think what stood out for me as well, was how easily Kamala Harris was able to sort of dispel a narrative that was also frustrating, and what I imagine was one of her main goals, right? How easily she was able to achieve that, which was basically to convince folks that she does have the chops, right? That she's not running from the press, that she does have sort of the professionalism and the intelligence and the capability, and in the worst form of the narrative that was put forward by Trump himself, that she's not a low IQ person who doesn't have the capabilities to be the United States president, right? She was able to sort of easily sort of dispel that narrative in the first 10, 15 minutes of watching her talk about this. I think that's really what stood out to me. And we have to imagine, you know, a lot of that obviously was underlaid by just sexism, perhaps racism as well. Kamala Harris has a completely traditional mainstream political resume to be in the position that she's in. Certainly speaking for sort of the post-Obama era, a completely traditional resume, right? From district attorney to attorney general of California, which has a larger population in some countries around the world, right, to being a senator and then to being vice president here. So the idea that was a question in the first place was certainly sexist, certainly at least smacked of racism. And I think one thing that stood out to me is she was able to sort of put that to rest very quickly, very easily.
And to that point, Hassan, and then we'll get Chris and Alex to weigh in. We keep hearing day after day, and I brought this up with our guests on Wednesday, day after day, that this race is razor thin close. Do you believe that? And what are your thoughts about Kamala Harris introducing herself? There are a lot of people out there who are not news junkies. They're not on social media. They're living their lives. And so a lot of people might not know a lot of details about Kamala Harris. I think that we use the same language sometimes because we hear these comments repeated over and over again in the media. Did it move the needle for people who might not know her or might still be undecided?
I would have to imagine it must have for some folks. How large a group that is, I think, is hard to say. I do think when you think through that question of sort of introducing herself, I sort of think of that in two ways, sort of like on a personal level, her own story. I think sort of the convention handled that, and I think that was the purpose of the convention in terms of her biography, right? We know how much President Barack Obama's biography had to play and in terms of his rise to leading the party. So we know that's important. I think they sort of already took care of that or sort of tried to handle that at the convention. I think in terms of introducing herself, that's more of a policy framework. And when you talk about the debate, I think she did a decent enough job at sort of parrying the second major critique, which I think is, again, her second major goal. The first one being showing that she does have the chops. I think the second one was sort of showing what she believes in, what she's going to put forth in detail, right? I think she did a fairly good job at laying out what she's going to do, what she's going to do that's different from Biden. Again, she didn't get super detailed with those things, but I think she did a decent enough job to sway some folks. Again, I'm trying to figure out how many people that might be or what percentage of the undecided population that might be. I think it's a difficult task.
But it's so important because of the Electoral College. A few thousand votes here and a few thousand votes there really matters. Any thoughts on the polling that we're hearing on a regular basis that this race is so close?
I mean, I think that what Harris did effectively was remind people of everything that they hated about the Trump era. And she didn't have to do very much to do that, right? Trump was for 90 minutes was just nonstop spewing all of the nonsense that people got very sick of. And that I think is effective. And she did, I think, a really strong job, also a stronger job than Joe Biden did in 2020, even of pointing to herself as the way out of all of this, you know, that she is a contrast in every possible way. And I think that, you know, the thesis statement of the debate for her was that she cares about normal people and relates to them, and Donald Trump only cares about himself. And that was evidenced both by her answers but mostly by Trump digging his own grave repeatedly. I think if there is a concern for me, though, you know, and I can hear the voice of the great Walter Shapiro, me and Chris's right. dearly departed colleague at the New Republic, you know, warning me to not look at crosstabs in a post-debate poll. But, you know, like Trump's voters, a vast majority of voters still trust Donald Trump more on economy and the and immigration. And those numbers didn't change based on this debate. That to me is still a warning sign. I think talking to undecided voters can be a fool's errand and a frustrating experience. But I do think that the thing that I have taken away from those conversations in places like Pennsylvania are that voters are still unclear or unsure of, you know, what Harris has done and what she will do. You know, I think that there's still work to be done there. And I think that the best thing for Harris here is that this debate performance was so strong that it just buys her more time to do that.
Going back to the polls, do you have anything to say about that, Alex? Just because they're just, it's every day, all day, we just keep hearing that they're so close. Do you believe that based on what you've read?
I mean, I think that the narrative that I'm clinging to, which I think is plausible, is that, you know, I think it's looked like a close election for a very long time, and it almost certainly will be because that's just the political world that we live in. But one of the things that we're seeing is that, you know, Trump support is growing in places like New York and California, right? And that the narrower popular vote margins that we seem to be headed towards might reflect that. But the good thing is that, you know, the swing state polls have continued to be strong for Harris, even as national polls have looked a little bit weaker for her. And, you know, I think we're seeing a tremendous amount of interest in this race in those places, in part because I think voters still want to know who Kamala Harris is and what she will do. And I think, you know, she did a decent job of that at the convention, but I think this was, you know, the strongest performance yet there. I mean, you know, I wish that this wasn't a close election. In some ways, it's shocking that it is, in part because I think one of the things that does come across when you talk to, you know, non-MAGA voters is just how tired people are of Donald Trump. And I think the wave of, you know, euphoria that we saw for Harris when she took over the nomination was also just a sense of relief that we wouldn't have to deal with another Biden-Trump election. And this debate performance, you know, was a sign, I think, or is the strongest sign yet that Harris can reach those people by presenting herself as a not just a plausible alternative, but also, you know, the way out of, you know, a political reality that most people just don't want any part of anymore.
Right. And we've been talking about this a lot lately. Based on the reporting that you both have done, why do you think this race is still close? Why do you think Donald Trump still has so much support, given everything that has happened with all of the lawsuits, with January 6th, the sexual assault? We could just go on and on. Hassan, what are your thoughts on that?
I think there's a number of answers to that. I think one inarguable answer to that is failures on the part of the media, right? Not to sound too partial, but present company excluded, right? I think you guys here, I know Alex and Chris certainly at their publications also sort of try to approach very intentionally, right? Make it clear to readers that we are approaching politics, including at the American Prospect, that we're trying to approach politics from a framework that isn't sort of the traditional horse race thing. And we're trying to really talk about what matters in people's lives. But I think if we're speaking about the broader media, I think, yeah, part of the blame lies at the media's feet. And that in terms of sort of not communicating certain issues to folks that about sort of the dangers that Trump represents to democracy, we can just sort of take the mass deportation issue as one thing that hasn't been clearly laid out, right? This came up in last night's debate, but same thing, right? Trump gave the answer that like part of how he's going to accomplish that is using the local police, but there was no follow-up from the moderators. There's not much follow-up from the moderators. There's not much pushback from Harris as a candidate to lay out exactly what this would look like, that this would look like pushing us even further into the territory of a police state, right? And that you have to actually identify folks who are, as they say, illegal. Use the word undocumented, which would be a much more humanitarian term. But to find all these illegal folks who are contraband in the views of the Trump administration would take a huge effort that would be a pretty authoritarian, draconian effort by any real measure. And that just wasn't probed last night. And there are many other questions like that, including Trump's recent tweet about all the folks he wants to go after if he does win, which includes donors. Apparently he's going to go after people like George Clooney somehow that donate to Democrats. I'm making a joke there, but my point is, if we actually assess that in the proper framework, if the media were to assess that in the proper framework and talk about this as a sort of playbook for dictators and authoritarian leaders, and how difficult it is once we start moving that direction to turn away, I think you would see the polls reflect what many of us know to be true, which is that Trump is a pretty unhinged person who is unfit to be president of the United States.
What are your thoughts, Chris, about how this race could still be so close and how so many millions of people could still be voting for Trump?
I think there's been a very consistent failure on the part of the mainstream press to communicate what the actual stakes are in the Trump era. And it goes back when Hassan was discussing the mass deportation plan, to use a generous term, Trump's agenda. I was reminded, you know, one of the first things Trump did in office was to start this new federal commission on violent immigrant crime, which statistically is a trend that really literally does not exist. Immigrants do not commit violent crime at any higher rate, and in fact, at a significantly lower rate than the native-born population. The point of this commission, which was hilariously shut down by a bunch of petty, personally motivated lies that people started phoning into neighbors they didn't like. And but, you know, the serious part of that is something that is quite literally fascist. It is designating a subgroup in the population as other than fully human, as, you know, and we see the same thing with the lie about Springfield's Haitian immigrants eating pets, which is just a flat out blood libel involving animals. And it is all of a piece. And if you have a press that just is always looking at the next shiny object and is scurrying from one outrageous statement to the next to document kind of meaningless reactions, you're not going to get that kind of broader ideological understanding of what's happening. The other thing that occurs to me from my unlamented tour as managing editor of Yahoo News during the Obama years. I still remember this quite vividly. The day that Obama released his long form birth certificate to silence the Trump-driven slander about him not being a native-born American, my bosses at Yahoo said, oh, we have to get the birther response, which is just like ludicrous and incoherent and wrong. And, you know, I did fight and got a piece up on the site that said that what this really is about race. This is about making America's first African-American president not seem like he's an American and therefore illegitimate in the role of president. But, you know, that's the thing, is you have to fight to get that narrative through this kind of brain dead, both sides, you know, rote treatment of basic news developments. You saw it just in the immediate after, it was the most predictable thing on earth, but in the immediate aftermath of the debate when it was over and after Harris clearly just wiped the floor with Donald Trump, the New York Times sent out its first piece about wrapping up the debate and saying, you know, it was a spirited debate in which views were vigorously exchanged. That tells you nothing, quite literally nothing. It doesn't describe the basic thing that happened, which is, in my view, the basic responsibility of journalism. So that's a long-winded answer, but I think we are dealing with a public discourse that has been deformed by incoherent bad thinking and, you know, crass capitalist incentives to keep people's nerve endings stimulated without any actual intellectual content.
These points are so important, and I want to spend a little more time on this because these words have consequences, and we live in a heavily armed society. So there's a piece that just ran in the Haitian Times called Haitian Families in Ohio Under Attack as Racist Claims Spread. This is by McElveen Neal. And it says, the morning after Trump repeated racist claims about Haitians in Springfield, some Haitian families are keeping their children home from school for their safety, according to an area activist. Those who allowed their children did so, but with heavy hearts. Aside from the anxiety caused by the debate, one woman said her cars have been vandalized twice in the middle of the night. She woke up one morning to broken windows and another to acid thrown on the vehicle. She's added cameras to her driveway and tried to report the incidents to the police to no avail. She said, I'm going to have to move because this area is no longer good for me. I can't even leave my house to go to Walmart. I am anxious and I'm scared. A number of families shared their accounts with the Haitian Times. So there's another angle to this. Same story I'm reading from. Some established residents have complained about quality of life issues. In particular, they've accused Haitians of being reckless drivers after a child, Aiden Clark, aged 11, was killed when his school bus and a car driven by a Haitian man collided last December. This is a tragic story. The piece goes on to say, Haitians and some residents, including the child's parents, have said the death is being used as an excuse to perpetrate racist attacks. At a city commission meeting held earlier in the night of the debate, picketers held up signs saying no more alongside signs of Trump's face. Aiden's parents begged for people to stop using their son's death for political gain. Nathan Clark, the boy's father, said, using Aiden as a political tool is, to say the least, reprehensible for any political purpose. They make it seem as though our wonderful Aiden appreciates your hate, that we should follow their hate. Morally bankrupt politicians, Bernie Moreno, Chip Roy, J.D. Vance, and Donald Trump, they have spoken my son's name and used his death for political gain. They can vomit all the hate they want about illegal immigrants, the border crisis, and even untrue claims about fluffy pets being ravaged and eaten by community members. However, they are not allowed, nor they have ever been allowed, to mention Aiden Clark from Springfield. Please stop the hate. So this is, again, there's a lot of memes going around about this, but these words have consequences, and we live in a violent society. Alex or Hassan, what are your thoughts about this and how it's being covered and how you think it should be covered from here? Hassan, why don't you go first?
I think along the same lines, you know, what you see from much of the mainstream media is a fact check. Right. Actually, that didn't happen. A city manager says in Springfield down there says there's no reports of Haitians eating people's, their neighbors' cats and that kind of thing. That does a disservice to the audience and to American voters. Right. To Chris's point, what the media should be doing, the appropriate role is to also explain why that lie is being told. That is to stoke racism in people. It is absolutely a blood libel, to use Chris's term. And it is to inspire feelings of hate and animosity and hostility towards people that are now becoming folks as neighbors around the country. Not even in that many cities, to be clear, by the way. The population of Haitian immigrants that's been coming to the country legally also for the past several years in which they've been in conflict is not some giant population that's going to touch most Americans, right? But yeah, I think that speaks, one, to the media failure to sort of address through line from things like birtherism and what that was meant to do, to when Trump was in office and there were some conflagrations in the Middle East, and he said, you know, these people have been fighting over sand for thousands of years, they'll never stop, it's in their nature, to now that Haitian immigrants are eating people's pets, right? There's a purpose behind all these, and it is to stoke hatred and to otherize people who are non-white Americans or legal residents here in America. And absolutely, words have consequences. We saw what happened very recently in England, where there were riots nationwide, where people were trying to rush into buildings holding asylum seekers and tried to burn the building, people inside of it, lit trash cans on fire and rolled them into the building. This continued for several days over there. All started, by the way, in the very same way as the Republican Party and Vice President did a couple of days ago, with a false meme on the internet. False meme going around on the internet gets promoted by people who are legitimate party politicians and gets believed by a bunch of people. And soon after that, you have folks in the streets trying to hurt their neighbors or people that they think are immigrants or just people who are identifiably not British, right? Which includes me and lots of other folks. And so I think that's what this is all about. And yeah, it's a disservice that the media does in that sort of explaining it within that framework of authoritarianism, of fascism, and of racism. And yes, to your point, it absolutely has consequences. And you know, when what happened in London happened, I thought through sort of how it got to that point and thinking within the American context, how we might, what could happen here to lead us to that point? And there's really no difference, right? There's no difference. The exact same thing that happened there could happen here. And whether it stops in 3 days, whether the trash can lit on fire actually catches the building on fire and kills a bunch of immigrants or not, sort of up to chance. And whether or not the police get there on time and actually do their job and do it well. So yeah, your point is absolutely well taken. There are absolutely consequences to these words, and that should be better explained to voters.
We're going to take a quick break. That is Hassan Ali Kanu, an award-winning reporter for The American Prospect. We're also joined by Alex Shepard, senior editor of The New Republic. Chris Lehman is D.C. bureau chief for The Nation, contributing editor at The Baffler, and author of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today's show is pre-taped, so I'm sorry we cannot take your phone calls. Today, we're joined by Chris Lehman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation, contributing editor at The Baffler, and author of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Hassan Ali Kanu is an award-winning reporter for The American Prospect, and Alex Shepard is senior editor with The New Republic. Alex, did you have anything to add before the break? We were just talking about what's going on with Ohio. I mean, you have to wonder, are the Republicans going to keep talking about this? But what are your thoughts about how the media should deal with just how crazy this all is? But then there are real consequences.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously vile. I mean, I had the somewhat surreal experience of hitting the chapter in Richard Evans's survey of Nazi leaders, Hitler's people, on Joseph Goebbels while all of this was happening. And it is Goebbels-like. And it's a reminder, too, that these things can be both vile and sort of, you know, treated almost with a wink, you know, as these sort of disgusting memes are. You know, we should remember, too, that this was motivated most strongly by J.D. Vance's desperate search for like his own couch meme to throw back at Democrats. And in doing so, he's decided to demonize and endanger an entire group of people. There was something that stood out to me in the way that he's talked about this, though, as well, which is that he talks about hearing from constituents, you know, who tell him about things. But it's notable that the constituents that he's talking about are not the Haitian people in Springfield, Ohio. And that, you know, that he does not think of immigrants in communities that he literally represents as being the people that he is speaking on behalf of. And overall, what you're seeing is a larger effort. You know, Trump has done this with migrants for decades now. You know, it's this idea that these are not people who are fleeing desperate circumstances in search of a better life. They are violent criminals and people from insane asylums, according to Donald Trump. And it's a hideous inversion of, you know, one of the theoretical, at least, you know, sort of foundational principles of America, an aspirational principle. But I also wanted to hit at something that I think has caused some of the media trouble here, which is that Kamala Harris is running a conservative platform on immigration, and she is not pushing back on these points. And I think you do have, I agree that there have been press failures here, but the way that the press largely works is still, you know, an inadequate both sides frame. But you know, Democrats weren't really hammering J.D. Vance about this disgusting pet thing. I mean, it happened at the debate, but it's largely been ignored. And I think that that is partly because Harris has essentially adopted the exact same framework as Donald Trump vis-a-vis the border crisis. And this one, you know, we've seen this in the UK, for example, when left parties adopt right-wing immigration policies, they don't benefit, but you do see a growing salience of those policies themselves. And I think that, you know, it's a real problem for Democrats because she is not winning voters who are concerned about the border. Instead, she's justifying Trump's, you know, extreme rhetoric and which could lead to, you know, literal fascism. And I think that it points to, I think, a failure of imagination and moral cowardice on their behalf, but also it suggests that they're not prepared to actually offer a real immigration policy. Instead, they're trafficking in similar, not as vile, but similar, a similar premise.
Again, just seconding what Alex has said, but yeah, I think the whole immigration, it's a testimony to the across the board institutional failure of our whole political culture that we are debating this immigration question in the terms set forth by Donald Trump. As I said earlier, you know, the basic premise of all of this moral panic is just a lie. It is this idea that immigrants are an unstable source of violent crime, that they're, you know, draining basic resources. You know, in the first debate with Joe Biden, Trump said that immigrants were going to bankrupt Social Security and Medicare, which is just an insane claim because they pay into the system and do not take benefits out. It is literally the opposite of what Trump was saying. So yeah, we have this bankrupt frame that has been just hammered and hammered and hammered away by Donald Trump and all the junior demagogues in the GOP like J.D. Vance. And it is literally made up. And it is beyond demoralizing to see, you know, Kamala Harris put on her prosecutor mien and say, oh, you know, I supported this border crackdown law that was going to make it through the House before Trump pulled the plug on it, was terrible. Like it eliminated most forms of asylum. It would bring back softer focused versions of family detention. Again, all in response, in the other piece of this has to do with the domestic gross national product, which the government's own estimates show that immigrants can contribute, you know, are slated to contribute $7 trillion to the American economy over the next 10 years. They are a major reason why we did not experience a recession during the COVID bounce back, because they were able to move nimbly into jobs that were suddenly open. So my response to the hysterical Trump Vance claims that this is an invasion, which you saw every stupid GOP primary rival echo and call for things like bombing Mexico. What population invades people by giving them $7 trillion? Like, literally, what are we talking about here? The other thing I was going to picking up on Alex's astute observation that when J.D. Vance is talking about his constituents, he's basically talking about white constituents. There was this moment in the debate last night that, as far as I know, no one really picked up on, where Trump was again dragging out his make-believe narrative of January 6th, that it was peaceful, patriotic, hardly anyone was injured or killed. And he said, the only people hurt were on, quote, the other side. And I would have loved for the moderators to say, what do you mean by the other side? Basically, what that means is people who want our democracy to function, want, you know, our House of Representatives to be open, want a legitimate election certified. So that's another form of the same othering dog whistle rhetoric that just, you know, skates right by because our sensibilities have been so coarsened by, you know, giving Donald Trump permission to be a omni-bigot, you know, so.
To your point about immigration, I just wanted to read this piece from Natasha Leonard at The Intercept. On the presidential debate stage, Trump spewed reliably racist and lie-riddled diatribes about towns being taken over from, quote, millions of people pouring into our country from prisons and jails, from mental institutions and insane asylums. Harris, for her part, did not bother to counter the sentiment, the central ideological violence at the heart of Trump's message. Harris, albeit in the predictably moderated tones of a Democratic border authoritarian, upheld the right-wing lie that immigration should be stopped. Both candidates purported to offer diametrically opposed visions for the country's future. When it came to immigration and the border, however, only one narrative was available throughout the night. Immigration is a social ill, if not a criminal endeavor, to be deterred as much as possible. Whenever I read about immigration or think about it, think about a piece that came out in The Nation many years ago. It was right around when Trump was running for president. I've got to find it because I really want to credit the writer. She found out that Trump's team, and this is not surprising, but I think it is important for context. When he decided to run, his team listened to hours upon hours of right-wing radio. and they learned that listeners hate immigrants. And that's one reason why it became just the focus of his campaign. And I just think that context is so important, Hassan, because how many undocumented immigrants work for Trump and have worked for Trump? I mean, does he really care about this issue? I mean, a lot of people say, well, that doesn't matter, but I think the context matters. Just to think about, where is this originating? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think there's not only the sort of service work that people generally think of when they think of that population, how Trump might personally feel about that, but also big money corporations like the Trump Organization was at one point, at least, are also happy to hire immigrants on their H-1B visas and things like that, right? But I think when we talk about this issue, and I'm an immigrant myself, right? I don't present as one to most average Americans' eyes, and they don't assume so. I also happen to have lived in Haiti for a year or so when I was a bit younger. It's a shame and insulting that I even feel that I should point out that, you know, I wasn't worried about my pets when I lived in Haiti. To Alex's point, I think it certainly cannot be encouraging to any immigrants, and especially to the Haitian immigrants that we're talking about, that there was no pushback from the other party, that there was no pushback from the other candidate, that this framework, like you read from the article, of that immigrants are just a social ill and a net negative, and contrary to the facts that Chris laid out, it's just sort of taken for granted at this point by both parties. And we saw this also on the issue of race, a similar thing. Lest we forget, in 2020, you had people around the world protesting in solidarity with Americans across the entire country, right, about race and specifically about policing and race. And the Democratic Party has dropped that issue. You had under Vice President and her president, our president, Joe Biden's administration, pivot when Joe Biden had that big State of the Union speech where he said, right, I'm going to give money and funding for 1,000 new officers. The right thing to do is not to defund the police, it's to fund the police, right? We saw that as well when Trump was asked about that issue, about saying that Kamala Harris wasn't Black until recently, and then took a half step back and then quickly took two more steps forward and doubled down on it. She didn't quite directly push back on that, either from a personal level, as a member of the immigrant community, or as someone who has a Black father, right? She didn't, or someone who has an Indian mother, didn't push back on that from any one of those perspectives. She just laid out Donald Trump's long history of racism that almost every American is aware of now, and nothing to follow up on about sort of why that's wrong, what the Democratic Party might have to say about those issues, actual platform items that they might do on policing or any other issues of race. And it was the same thing with immigration. There's just the slightest bit of what we can call pushback, but then the framework is the entire same. This is a social ill, and actually we are going to compete with Donald Trump to see how many of these people we can keep out and how many of these people's lives we can make more difficult if they do get in. So yeah, I think that all in all, it's really discouraging to those folks who are in the Democrats' core base, that they don't get any of what they might be looking for from the party in terms of their unique interests.
And I was going to say what explains that, but it's pretty obvious because the media coverage is just nonstop. And once again, the needle has really moved on this issue. But again, you have to wonder, you know, what is she going to do if she wins on this issue? Is it going to be to sign that conservative border bill and that's it? Or she's going to do something about Dreamers, about the path toward citizenship. It can't just be that bill.
Can't it?
Really?
Yeah, she has pledged that she will sign that bill. I guess, you know, if you want to be more hopeful, if she wins, maybe there'll be a big enough Democratic majority that the bill can get reworked, or that the vastly popular, it's still amazing to me, you know, issue polling shows that like, 75% of Americans support a path to citizenship for the Dreamers. This should not be difficult. But obviously, because one party has so successfully transformed this into a base mobilization strategy, and the other party just capitulates. That's the larger story here, is there are things to reform in our immigration system. Those are reforms like the DREAM Act that make sense, that vast majorities support, and there evidently is no way forward given our occluded political structure.
Right. And again, I think it's so important to remember that we're talking about human beings here.
Right.
That's the thing that bothers me about a lot of these conversations, is it's just immigrants, and the way that they're talked about is just so ugly and so brutal. And it's important to remember that people are suffering as we're speaking right now at the border in horrific conditions. And there was a big story that broke about a month ago. I'm just reading from a PBS headline. Migrant children suffered severe sexual abuse under housing providers' care, according to the DOJ. So this is just really ugly. And I just think it's important to remember that we're talking about human beings here.
And it's, yeah, it's especially striking when it's juxtaposed to all of this, you know, sort of phony pets,
Exactly.
The MAGA world cares much more about pets that are not actually being kidnapped and eaten than they do about actual people who are in, you know, serious peril at the border.
Right.
One thing that stood out to me too is, you know, the central policy, to the extent it was one of Donald Trump's first run for president, was a metaphor, right? The border wall was a literal wall, but it was also a metaphor. The idea was that fixing immigration was so simple, but the politicians in Washington were, you know, occluded and corrupt, and all we had to do was just build this giant wall and that would fix everything. And that was ridiculous and it's offensive. And yet that has like disappeared from the narrative. And, you know, Kamala Harris is building the wall here. And in general, that approach to immigration, this kind of, we're going to shut down the border, we're going to deport people, you know, we have to stop the criminals and drugs from getting through, has been adopted by both parties. And one of the things that alarms me about that is that I think, to get back to a question you asked earlier, Rose, about why this election is so close, one reason is that, you know, Trump's support, and I think you hear this from undecided voters as well, you know, is rooted in something that's real for a lot of people, which is that they see a political system that is unresponsive to their needs, right? And that they think of as only benefiting certain people. And many of those people have become coarsened and racist because of that. But, you know, I think that the way out of that is to make a persuasive, and I think progressive, case that Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party can build the system that works for these people in these kind of clear ways. And that these kind of reactionary policies only make things worse for people. And I think that, you know, this is another failure of media coverage as well, is that the narrative of just Trump says crazy thing often ignores the fact that the crazy things that he's proposing also don't make those people's lives better either, right? They don't make a system more responsive. They don't fix endemic income inequality or violent crime for that matter. And when that's missing, I think that's still the thing that's missing from Harris's campaign. And you saw it yesterday is, okay, you know, you're different. You're a decent person than Donald Trump. That's a huge advantage and it's a great start, but she needs to go to win over people that are still skeptical is to also make the case that not only, you know, does she have a vision to make a system that is less broken and screwed up, but also that the policies advocated by Donald Trump don't actually do anything to fix anything. In fact, they make it much worse.
Hassan, did you want to jump in?
Yeah. I was just going to add that, you know, I wish I had the poll at handy at the moment, but I recall looking at some polls recently where, you know, if you ask folks nowadays and not sort of connected to DACA or anything like that, but if you ask them in isolation about just limiting immigration generally, or even deporting people who are in the country, you get a pretty alarmingly high percentage of Americans who are generally supportive of that, right? They might not be super gung-ho, but they're generally of the notion that we should be limiting immigration and maybe getting rid of some people. I think that speaks to, you know, we spent plenty of time sort of criticizing our industry and our colleagues in the media, but to Alex's point, a good deal of the blame lies on the Democrats' feet too, right? That's also a failure on their part for sort of not explaining that issue and making it clear why it's not only a humanitarian issue, as you point out, Rose, but also why it's a fundamental part of our identity as Americans, right? There are principles and really important principles that underlie the reason why we call ourselves a nation of immigrants. And that's entirely lost now in this conversation. And yeah, you can certainly point at the Democrats for not making that case.
We have a couple minutes left, and I just want to talk about Israel and Gaza. And again, just to humanize this, more than 40,000 Palestinians have been killed, including 17,000 children. The Lancet says it could exceed 186,000. Again, we've heard Vice President Harris talk about this issue many times, saying that Israel has the right to defend itself and there should be an immediate ceasefire and eventually a two-state solution. So this is not happening. What are your thoughts about how this could affect her in less than 2 months with the uncommitted movement? Michigan is very important. I didn't even know that Little Palestine existed in Chicago until the Democratic convention. The language is very different from Biden. But do you think she's going to do anything in practice that's different from Biden? And when you look at the polling, CBS, 61% of people in the U.S. say the U.S. should not send weapons to Israel, including 77% of Democrats and nearly 40% of Republicans. So what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, first, I would
Chris.
Say, unfortunately, I don't think the language is that different from Biden's language. There is this kind of wishful invocation of a two-state solution, which on no planet with Bibi Netanyahu as the prime minister of Israel is ever going to happen. So it's kind of like, you know, waiting for the Easter Bunny to solve the crisis. And yeah, I was really dismayed, not that it surprised me, in last night's performance. You know, Harris actually gave a pretty careful, measured account of the Biden administration's role in the Ukraine war and bringing NATO allies along and how this reflects our fundamental values as a nation to preserve a country under attack and in peril. And then when the discussion turned to Gaza, there was none of that. It was basically, we're just going to continue doing whatever Netanyahu wants. And that is appalling genocidal conflict that you just characterized at the outset here. So it's another instance in which the Democratic Party has failed. And I, you know, to answer your question, yeah, it's unclear what the, you know, electoral fallout is, but is going to be. But Harris is not doing any concerned Americans any favors by, you know, just punting on this question. And it's a different order of question. You know, it is about arresting a genocide. You know, it makes me uneasy even to talk about it in these kind of crass electoral terms. You know, it is morally wrong for us to be sending arms to Israel right now.
Hassan or Alex, would you like to add anything?
One of the things that stood out to me about her answer is, I mean, it's not materially different than the Biden administration's policy. And I think that, you know, Harris is crossing her fingers that if elected, that this will have gone, you know, gone away before she takes the oath of office. But in some ways, the advantage of Harris over Biden creates, I think, a bigger problem for her in that she, unlike Joe Biden, does recognize the humanity of Palestinians. And has, you know, speaks about it in moral or moral-ish terms. She certainly addresses civilian casualties, but that just leads to more follow-up questions, the biggest of which being, okay, well, what are you going to do about it? The contradiction of her approach is apparent every time she speaks about it. So I, too, do not know how it will affect the election, but, you know, it is clear that the inadequacy of her posturing here, you know, it's apparent every time she opens her mouth, you know, on this issue. I think there's no possibility that we will get a more significant break from Biden between now and the election. You know, the hope just has to be that, you know, if elected, that she will take a much stronger stance, because for one thing, I think also Netanyahu is not going to listen to her at all either. So the idea is that she'll have some sort of sway over him. It's preposterous.
Well, given that we are so close to election day, I mean, we think about this all the time, is what's the best use of our time at this point? What should we focus on? How are you all thinking about that? Hassan?
Oh, man, that is a difficult one. It's a difficult question to answer. I mean, it's hard to even parse what one party is offering at all. And the other party doesn't have a very detailed plan at this point. Kind of funny that the Harris campaigns, when they updated their website to release the platform, ended up looking a lot like what Trump has been releasing in the past few elections, right? Which just looks like a bunch of sort of undetailed talking points that, like, you can fill in the blanks of the details once you get into office, and they can even be completely different than what was promised up front. And she sort of released something like that. So it's really hard to think through that. I mean, I don't know. I think I really might still be at the place of that a lot of folks were when Biden dropped out. I'm sort of thinking about this as a moment where, you know, one choice we avoid authoritarianism, and one other choice we take a very big hop and a skip and a jump to possibly landing squarely in authoritarianism. And so I don't know. I guess I'm keeping my eye on anything that can seriously hurt Harris. And it seems like their strategy at this point is to stay relatively quiet and to keep things undetailed and hope that gets her across the finish line. So I'm really not sure what to pay attention to be quite honest.
Chris, what are your thoughts? What would you add?
My main thought is I'm glad you initially directed that question to someone else. But, you know, this is, I guess, a somewhat trite civics class kind of answer. But like, it does remain the case that for all of my very deep differences with Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party, this is an election where our democracy is on the ballot. I wish I could find some less cliched way to say that. But it is actually an urgent question of whether half of this country is going to throw in with someone who is a slovenly, inattentive, morally obtuse authoritarian figure, but an authoritarian figure nonetheless, who has a massive policy armada in the form of Project 2025 lined up to purge the civil service, to set up intrastate abortion monitors, to, you know, get rid of the Department of Education, all of that. So the one thing I share Hassan's and Alex's kind of frustrations with the lack of deep policy detail on the Harris campaign, but I was heartened when they did put up policy positions on their website. They have at the bottom of each entry a link out to what Project 2025 says about the same issues. And I think that contrast is really important to keep drawing.
Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly echo what Chris and Hassan said yet again. But, you know, I think for me, the question that I keep asking about this election is where precisely is the Democratic Party in this moment? I think that, you know, the 2020 primary kind of made that clear as a result of 18 months of interminable infighting and debate. But, you know, ultimately there was, you know, a vision that made a lot of sense for that moment. And a lot of that stuff has changed now. And I think Harris is still trying to figure out precisely where the kind of middle she's comfortable being in is. But what is very clear is that the party that the Democrats are running against is singularly extreme and dangerous. And that the consequences, even if they were to succeed in only, you know, a tenth of the 965 pages of Project 2025, or a tenth of the 10 million people that 20 million people that Donald Trump wants to deport, you know, would just be utterly catastrophic. And I think that voters were understandably, I think, tuned out, you know, until the first debate. But you're getting a real sense now that people are paying attention. And I think that was made, the contrast there was made very clear in Tuesday's debate. And that I find heartening, even though I remain quite anxious about the state of the race.
Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic. Hassan Ali Kanu is an award-winning reporter with The American Prospect. Chris Lehman is DC Bureau Chief for The Nation, contributing editor at The Baffler, and author of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Thank you all for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.